It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Over the past decade, online retail has increased fivefold. Last year, it accounted for about 7% of all retail revenue, according to the research firm Forrester. There are many reasons for the surge. In some cases, better service, better price, better selection. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, these days you can find just about anything online.
There's almost nothing Ann Houseman won't or doesn't buy online. Take, for example, her living room.
So both of our end tables we got at Overstock.com. We hadn't seen them in person, but we just saw them online, read the reviews, thought they were great, and ordered them.
And the adjoining kitchen.
So here are our dishes that I was saying, our entire dish set. So we got our coffee maker, Le Creuset pot over there. Got that online.
Nearly all of the bedroom was also purchased online.
Everything from our mattress was purchased from Overstock.com, this entire bed set, the bedspread, the pillows, dressers. We have two different dressers here.
And since Houseman is expecting a baby girl in July, she used Pinterest, the online scrapbooking site, to help her design a nursery. Then she furnished it largely from items purchased online. Come to think of it, Houseman says, you could say they bought their home in Woodbridge, Virginia, online, using the web-based brokerage Redfin. And they bought both their cars on Autotrader.com. Houseman embodies the new frontier of retail. Over time, her love of the convenience trumped concerns about using credit cards online and the hassle of returns. Customer service, she says, is better. Some e-tailers even respond to tweeted consumer complaints. By her own estimate, 80% of what she spends goes to e-tailers. John Burbank is president of strategic initiatives for Nielsen, a market research firm. Retail behavior, he says, is changing very quickly.
Kids who are growing up today are going to come into a world that's very, very different.
They use mobile apps to research or comparison shop in the store. They rely on Amazon Prime, a service that charges an annual fee in return for almost unlimited free shipping. But that, Burbank says, is just the beginning.
There'll be different technology. There'll be different business practices. There'll be all sorts of incentives that don't exist today to move them to shop in different ways.
And the Housemans are very receptive to incentives. In the past couple of years, Ann Houseman has changed her habits around flash sale sites like Gilt Group and Rue La La. These sites offer sales for a limited time on limited quantities of luxury items. So Houseman actually structures her day around when these web boutiques open.
I think Rue La La opens at 11 and Gilt is at noon. I can't wait for that because I'm not making impulse purchases per se, but it is nice to like see like, ooh, what's new and what might be there that I need anyway that I can find at a deal.
Andrew Houseman, Anne's husband, likes the ability to custom order things from the web, like the mugs he has in his hand.
These are all custom-made beer steins from Zazzle.
He also says it's difficult to shop without the reviews, ratings, and research he finds online. On the rare occasion he goes to a store, he uses bar scanning applications on his phone to get information on products. When the Housemans come home, there's usually a stack of boxes waiting for them. They keep a small knife by the door to open them. Today, the stack is 6 deep.
This is an item that I didn't know was coming, so this is good.
The haul includes a film to put on windows to conserve energy, a changing table, and a red and chartreuse summer jumper for the baby. To many, the boxes are a wasteful nuisance, a downside to deliveries. But even this, Houseman doesn't consider a problem.
When the boxes actually arrive, it's like getting little presents in the mail. You know, you get the satisfaction of it twice. You bought it, and you were happy then, and then you're happy when you get to see it.
And at any rate, she says, recycling day is tomorrow. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Companies like Apple, Google, and Amazon are trying to get more customers to store everything from family photos to favorite films online in what's known as cloud-based storage. Today, a hearing in the criminal copyright case of the file-sharing site Mega Upload could have implications for all kinds of cloud-based businesses. The hearing will focus on what happens when clearly legal files get blocked by authorities along with allegedly illegal ones. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Kyle Godwin was a customer of Mega Upload, and last January he was having a very bad day. He's building a new business taking videos of local sports teams in Cleveland. He sells highlights to family and friends of the players. He backed all his material up on a hard drive, but then...
Right in the middle of a save, I knocked it off my coffee table and it hit the floor. And I can't get any of the files off of that external hard drive, and that was basically everything I've worked on for the last 6 months.
Arg. Then Godwin remembered he had a paid account with Mega Upload where he had most of his files backed up. Godwin went to the site to retrieve his videos.
But all I got was the opening screen, and I couldn't get into any of the files, couldn't get into the file manager. I didn't know what was going on.
What was going on was that the Justice Department had shut down Mega Upload and arrested several of its top executives for criminal copyright infringement. The DOJ claimed that the vast majority of traffic from the site's 66 million customers was illegal.
When I heard about that, I'm like, this doesn't even involve me. So how do I get my files back? I need them now.
Godwin may never get them back. That's what the lawyers are in court about this morning. Mega Upload rented servers from a company called Carpathia Hosting. That's where Godwin's files are. Mega Upload is the only one that can unlock the files of customers like Kyle Godwin, and they have been shut out by the federal government. Carpathia is asking a federal court to tell it what to do with the servers. The Justice Department refused to give an interview, but in court documents, it's asking the judge not to get involved in what it calls a private contractual matter between Carpathia and Mega Upload. The online civil rights group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is filing a brief on behalf of Godwin and other innocent customers. Julie Samuels is an attorney with the EFF, and she says this online case shouldn't be any different than a real-world case, say if a bank were to be seized.
There are innocent third parties who might have items at that bank in a safety deposit box and some other kind of deposit account, and the law and the Constitution, frankly, contemplate a way for those innocent third parties to get their grandmother's pearls back.
Samuel says there's no reason that the digital world should be different from the real one. Except, well, it is. Jim Berger, a copyright attorney, says in this case we are talking about a huge amount of material and the court would probably have to appoint someone to sort through it.
To say, oh yes, this 100 megabytes is Mr. Smith's and it's legal, it's his personal stuff, but this 50 megabytes is clearly infringing. It would take forever to sort humans to sort through 25 petabytes of data.
Yet Berger and Samuels agree that the implications of what happens to the material on the servers are great. Companies like Google, Amazon, and Apple are trying to entice their customers to store more stuff online, from family photos to legally purchased films. If Mega Upload's legitimate customers can't retrieve their files, Berger admits many people will be afraid to use cloud storage.
If I'm in the cloud business, I want this done right.
Ultimately, says Berger, there are no laws directly applicable. It will be up to the judge to determine what is fair. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
These days, between a surrogate, an egg donor, and a sperm donor, it can take a village to create a child. We've been reporting this week on the complex issues involving women who carry a child for someone else. Technology is helping many same-sex couples and others who never thought they'd be able to have children, but the law has not kept pace. For the final part of our series, Making Babies, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on the legal debate over a key question. With all these people involved, who's the parent?
For thousands of years, there's been no doubt. A woman who gives birth is that child's mother, and her husband, the legal father. But 25 years ago, a challenge to this exploded into a courtroom battle that riveted the nation.
When she found out she'd never give birth.
I could give them the greatest gift of all, the gift of life.
ABC aired this television drama on the Baby M case. A woman was hired to have a baby for a New Jersey couple, then changed her mind.
I have to keep my baby.
You already have two children. I have none.
Based on a true story.
No!
In 1988, New Jersey's Supreme Court declared surrogacy contracts invalid, saying there are, in a civilized society, some things that money cannot buy. The Baby M case was the first public debate about surrogacy, and its ruling had a profound effect. Many states passed laws to restrict surrogacy. And yet, since then, the practice has exploded, with 1,400 babies born to U.S. surrogates in 2010 and likely many more unreported.
Oh, yes. We've got surrogacy companies. We've got the internet. It is a big, big change.
Michelle Zavis is a family law attorney in Maryland and says the legal issues have only grown more complicated. The surrogate in the Baby M case used her own eggs. But today, nearly all surrogates become pregnant through in vitro fertilization using another woman's eggs. Sometimes those eggs are from the woman who wants to be a mother. Sometimes they're from a donor.
So the question for the courts and for the legislatures are, who is the legal parent and how do we determine that?
Steve Snyder of the American Bar Association says many family laws were written years, if not decades ago. Even basic legal terms like biological mother can now seem unclear.
Well, now one woman can give birth and another woman can provide the egg. So what did they mean by biology?
Snyder and Zavis are among a growing number of lawyers pushing for a broader definition of parent, one based simply on someone's intent.
Is it somebody who decides to have children with somebody else, who acts as a parent throughout a child's life? Is it somebody that the biological or legal parent invites in to be a parent?
Zavis believes the answer should be yes, yes, yes. A few courts have recognized intent, and some states have passed laws to make surrogacy easier. But the practice is largely unregulated, and lawyers are left to work through a tangle of varied and conflicting state laws. Their aim, to create legal parenthood where it never existed. They may use adoption or something called voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. Some states now allow a pre-birth order, which designates the intended parents and allows their names, instead of the surrogates, to go on a birth certificate. Attorney Snyder says each case can feel like a puzzle.
So the question is, like a Rubik's Cube, how do we get intended mom on the blue side with all the other blue pieces and get the surrogate, the yellow piece, off of there?
This is not for some trial judge in a family court to make up law.
Harold Cassidy was the lawyer for the surrogate in the Baby M case, and he still defends surrogates who change their mind. Pregnancy is profound, he says, and in aiming to help infertile couples, legal contracts ignore the rights of the woman who gives birth.
In many ways, these contracts are uninformed because the woman is asked to make a promise to do something before the child's even conceived.
The bond and love for the girls that developed was far more powerful than anything I ever expected.
Gail Robinson is one of Cassidy's clients. In 2005, she agreed to carry twins for her brother and his partner. But after a falling out, she sued for custody. Because part of her case is on appeal, Robinson declined to be interviewed, but agreed to read a statement to NPR.
The growing sense of moral obligation to my daughters increased as I realized that my daughters needed their mother.
Robinson lives in New Jersey, the same state where the Baby M case played out and where the law still deems surrogacy invalid. A court found Robinson to be a lawful parent, and late last year she was awarded visitation rights, even though she has no genetic connection to the twins she carried.
The law has not embraced the concept of separating motherhood from giving birth.
Attorney Steve Snyder says society accepts that sperm or egg donors are not parents, but pregnancy seems sacred.
To believe that a woman can have no remorse or resistance to giving the child up is at direct odds with our societal notion of what motherhood is, even though that was her intent before she ever got pregnant.
What's more, Snyder says surrogacy generates opposition because it touches on hot-button issues from abortion to same-sex marriage. Still, attorney Michelle Zavis believes the law will eventually recognize those who intend to be parents. After all,
technology is leading it. Of course it is. People can have children, and the most important thing is, are they going to be a good parent?
One thing both sides agree on: the need for more legislation to regulate surrogacy. But that's not likely to happen without more consensus on who is a parent. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
The city of Palo Alto, California, recently hosted a 12-hour bonanza for software developers, artists, and families. It was called Super Happy Block Party Hackathon, and it was a marathon for programmers to make new software in a short amount of time. It also featured food trucks, music, and homemade robots. Corey Takahashi reports.
The city of Palo Alto wants to redefine the word hacker as a term for a creator or innovator, not a lawbreaker. Its 34-year-old mayor, Yahweh Ye, supports this message.
When you talked about hacking before, it would have been almost weird to think that hacking and government went hand in hand. You know, in the past, hacking was always about how you broke into systems and how you accessed information that was really safeguarded.
But in a tech center like Palo Alto, hacking is just part of a party. The event takes over one of downtown's busiest streets and draws in families and the general public. Co-organizer Frederick Herman says even venture capitalists are standing by.
And people can even pitch their ideas and maybe get funding for them.
Where are the VCs?
The legend of multinational tech companies born in garages defines this city's story. So when stormy weather threatens to short-circuit the fun, organizers just move into a giant city parking garage. To the delight of co-organizer Celestine Johnson.
You just think of it like layers in a dream. Like, you enter the garage, you have no idea what to expect. You see people painting on all these canvases. You see people eating from the food trucks. You go up to the next level. It's startups and parklets. There's a tech petting zoo.
A tech petting zoo, improvised robots, coding classes for kids. John Milinovich says adults also appreciate the friendly, open vibe.
So I work at Google. Jayant Sai works at LinkedIn.
This all-star team is building an iPhone app that turns personal fitness data into a game. Like the hackathon itself, their app is a mashup of the physical and virtual. The developers test their app on iPhones, but they also run tests with endless rounds of jumping jacks.
I'm just thinking from a pitch perspective, it would be perfect if we could get you on stage actually doing the jumping jacks and showing that it's actually counting.
This team and the inaugural Super Happy Block Party Hackathon are fueled by pizza, caffeine, and big dreams. And both rage on until 1 a.m. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, we wrestle with a question that could have big implications for the U.S. economy. Are we in the middle of the next tech bubble? First, a few numbers. On the first day of its initial public offering, LinkedIn is valued at nearly $9 billion. And that's nothing compared to Instagram. Facebook dropped $1 billion to buy that company last week, even though the tiny photo-sharing startup brings in no money at all. Then again, with Facebook's own value drawing estimates of $75, even $100 billion, what's a billion here or there? Well, to some, these dollar signs are warning signs. For more, we're joined by NPR technology reporter Steve Henn. Welcome, Steve.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Steve Blank, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and now adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. Hi there, Steve Blank.
Hi. Great to be here.
So let's start with some ground rules here. Steve Henn, exactly what is the definition of a tech bubble? I understand there are at least four stages.
Yeah, I think most people think of bubbles as investment manias that are formed by irrational exuberance. But a professor at Hofstra, Jean-Paul Rodriguez, outlined how a bubble gets started, how it grows, and then how it bursts. And it's become pretty popular to talk about the four stages of bubbles, starting with the stealth stage, where really smart investors recognize a really big opportunity and start pouring money in. And then slowly awareness of that opportunity builds, and institutional investors start investing as well. And then the bubble really starts to inflate in what folks talk about as the mania phase, where the media, like us, start talking about it, and the public starts investing. And this, if it begins with the smart money, this might be the dumb money phase, where people are investing based on the momentum and the excitement around this perceived opportunity. And then the last, which unfortunately we're all very familiar with, which is when the bubble pops.
So, Professor Steve Blank, by those stages, do you think we're in a bubble?
Oh, I think we're in a bubble big time. I think it's one of the most exciting times in Silicon Valley in the last 20 years.
So you're excited, but the part I remember about the four stages that Steve Henn just described is the crash after. So, I mean, tell us, what are we in for here if this, as you believe, is a tech bubble?
Well, I think we'll have a crash. But unlike other bubbles, there's something unique about a technology bubble that actually is great for the country and great for innovation.
What is that?
Unlike other bubbles, like financial bubbles and housing bubbles, you know, nerds don't seem to buy yachts. They seem to reinvest in their own domain. And one of the interesting phenomena about this bubble, it's based on the money that was made in the last bubble. And that's coupled with something else that's very exciting about this bubble as well.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, I want to go back to Steve Henn for a second. I feel like we were all reporting on Pets.com and, you know, the graveyard of other tech companies that didn't survive. I mean, am I just too sensitive here to the news?
Well, maybe. You know, I think at this point, at least, this enthusiasm in the technology market is different from sort of the Pets.com era. I mean, if you look at the four biggest technology companies in the country, Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, three of the four have, you know, stock prices that are relatively sanely priced. And I think where we're seeing the kind of irrational excitement is at a much earlier stage. You're seeing investors in Silicon Valley get so excited about potential opportunities that they're valuing really small, unproven companies at really crazy amounts. It's not like Pets.com where your grandmother was investing in the stock.
So Professor Steve Blank, is really the difference here the fact that the public doesn't have access and can't make that bubble bigger?
Well, there are a couple of real interesting distinctions between this bubble and the one in the turn of the century. Let me say it again. I still believe we're in a bubble, but I actually think this one is good and probably much better than the last one. The last bubble, if you remember, you didn't even have to have revenue to go public. You just had to have an E or internet or wireless or something, and people were buying it. It was the greater fool theory. And
but
it was
this
not
is
only,
different from Instagram then?
Yeah, and that's a great distinction, and there's two key ideas here. One is this bubble is pretty narrow. What we're seeing are inflated values for internet apps. And the reason why is pretty spectacular, is that for the first time we can imagine companies having not tens of millions, not hundreds of millions, but Facebook is approaching a billion customers, a billion people using the same application. And so Instagram didn't have revenue, but they had 30 million users in 2 years.
So, Steve Blank, you seem to be rosy, basically, about the idea of there being a bubble, but bubbles burst, and that's usually a bad thing, right?
You know, it's a bad thing if you're the greater fool at the end of the game of musical chairs.
Right, which is a lot of us, you know, say if you look at the housing bubble.
But I think we're going to look back at this decade as the beginning of an economic revolution as important as anything in the 16th century or in the Industrial Revolution. And it's really going to change the quality of life across the entire planet. And if that sounds like a lot for just Facebook and Instagram, you ain't seen anything yet.
But I get what you're saying, but it's just like, is this the internal combustion engine or is this Instagram? Like, are these really things that are going to fundamentally change the way we live? Or are you just saying that it's going to build a kind of infrastructure to our economy that will be different?
I think looking at any one of these, you could laugh hysterically and say, you know, this is it. I think it's the sum of these and the amount of capital that it will return into the entrepreneurial engine. But why it's great for the country is this is how things get built. The railroads were built in a bubble. Oil was built in a bubble. But it's returned capital to something that made this country dramatically transformed, and we're going to see that again.
So, Steve Henn, one last thing. On the list of four stages, one of the stages is rationalization, right? Everyone basically saying all the reasons why this bubble is different or this bubble doesn't exist.
That's right.
What do you think of that? Do you hear a lot of rationalizing going on for what's happening in the industry?
Yeah, I think you do hear a certain amount of rationalizing going on. That's not to say that these underlying technologies won't really pan out for many people and many companies, but I think also there will be lots of failures along the way and lots of investors who lose money as these changes play out in our economy.
That's NPR technology reporter Steve Henn. Thanks so much, Steve.
Sure thing.
And Professor Steve Blank, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and now adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. Professor Blank, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR. A top priority in Congress this week, legislation to bolster cybersecurity. Lawmakers have introduced a variety of bills, and the main difference among them is whether the government should require companies to build up their cyber defenses or just encourage them. NPR's Tom Gelton reports that the White House is pushing hard for a mandate.
It's only been recently that the notion of an attack on U.S. computer networks even registered as a security threat. But there's now a big concern that an enemy could use cyber weapons to take down a power grid, a water treatment facility, or a pipeline, in other words, the nation's critical infrastructure. The ability to defend against such an attack is improving. What's needed now are new laws and policies to support the nation's cyber defenses. On that, nearly everyone agrees. But should private firms like power companies be required to protect their computer systems? That's the question. The White House says yes. John Brennan is the president's counterterrorism and homeland security advisor.
We believe, particularly in the area of critical infrastructure, that the companies that are responsible for that critical infrastructure need to meet certain standards of cybersecurity protection. This is where the debate is centered right now.
Brennan says most companies on their own are spending the money and doing what they need to do to protect the computer systems from attack. They don't mind having to meet certain minimum security standards, he says. But other companies don't want to be told what to do.
Some, for whatever reason, whether it be for monetary purposes or because they just have poor security practices, are reluctant to have the government set these standards.
The White House strongly supports legislation pending in the Senate that would establish minimum cybersecurity standards companies have to meet. But that proposal has run into stiff opposition from business groups. An alternative bill moving on the House side only encourages better cybersecurity. Representative Dutch Ruppersberger, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, told reporters last week that the bill would have the government issue alerts about imminent cyber attacks or dangerous new software, but the bill would not require that anything be done with that information.
It clearly goes to the private sector, who then uses their resources to protect their customers and themselves, and it's only voluntary if they want to come back to the government.
The question of whether to promote voluntary cybersecurity measures or require adherence to minimum standards will loom large in the legislative debate coming in the next few weeks. White House advisor John Brennan says the threat of cyber attacks is so serious that the government has a responsibility to make sure the nation's critical infrastructure is well protected.
We have these standards when it applies to the aviation industry. We have it on in so many different areas. I would think that the American people would like some assurance that the water that they drink, that the electricity that they rely on is going to be protected. And we well know that the cyber threats that are out there are just growing every day.
But it's not easy in an election year to promote new government regulations and additional mandates. Some advocates of tougher cybersecurity standards say it may just make sense to pass whatever measures are politically possible right now and then to build on them later when the threat of cyber attacks becomes more real than it may appear to be right now. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.